What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal, and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and we're back with part two of our series on mud. Now, in the last episode, we talked about some sort of definitional constraints on the idea of mud. And yes, it is the mud you're thinking of, as in wet soil, typically composed of small particles of the silt or clay particle size variety. But we also talked about mud in the sort of geohistory of Earth, in the history of how the continents were colonized by early plants and animals, terrestrial life, and how the presence of mud was sort of driven by the presence of plants on Earth's continents, and then how the buildup of mud on the continents from there sort of shaped the way the continents developed. But before that, we also talked about a passage in The Faery Queen, which is a late 16th century English epic poem by the poet Edmund Spenser, in which the author talks about his belief that the mud of the Nile, and maybe just mud in general, spawns monsters. And I knew we were not done with the idea of monsters that grow out of mud. Surely there's going to be a lot of that going around. And Rob, I think you had one as well, didn't you?
Yeah, I actually looked into this a little bit last year because I worked a mud monster into the script I wrote for 13 Days of Halloween last year. And I was looking for inspiration regarding mud monsters. And at least at the time, I didn't find as many as I thought I would. But I did find one really interesting one. This one is a yokai from Japanese traditions, and it's known as the Dorotabo. This name means either mud man or rice paddy man, and this yokai is generally described and depicted as a humanoid made out of mud, or at least a torso of a humanoid made out of mud, emerging from the mud of a rice paddy, grasping with its arms and staring out through a single eye in its head as it wails at the night.
It's brutal looking. It's got a kind of mud skeleton, like you can see the ribs at least.
Yeah, it's a frightening looking yokai, that's for sure. Of course, frightening in yokai doesn't necessarily mean it's going to try to kill you. Well, that's how it basically breaks down in this one. I have a really fun yokai book that my son and I read last year. This is from Hiroko Yoda and Matt Alt. It's titled Yokai Attack. It's a fun little book that has some great illustrations. And they point out that the Dorotabo is not generally believed to be dangerous. It cries and frightens those who encounter it, but that's about it. Some traditions say that it originated as a man who lost his hard-won farmland and now, haunting the rice fields, cries for its return in the night.
Wait, the return of the fields? Like, as the mud monster, he wants to now again be the rightful owner of the fields?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's like, this was my place, and now you've taken it from me. You know, basic haunting 101, right? Mm-hmm. But the authors here also share that the Dorotabo's origins go back at least as far as Seiken Toriyama's famous 18th century yokai book, Tales of Monsters Then and Now. And while it might be based on pre-existing folktales, they think it's more likely the creation of Toriyama himself. And it's one of these things where it's the frightening spirit here loses some of its appeal when it seems that it might have been little more than the embodiment of a crude sexual metaphor to stick a pole in the rice paddy. So maybe its origins are less spooky and more just kind of skeezy, but still, and the thing is, you can see that too if you look at some of these illustrations. I mean, the monster's appearance is vaguely phallic, and the authors point out that Seiken may have been referencing brothels that were located north of Edo Castle at the time.
Mm.
But whatever the road to get there, the result is a pretty cool looking mud monster.
Now, while we're on the topic of the intersection between mud and monsters, there is a movie example that I know we have to talk about. It's one not of a monster made of mud, but of a hero who must defeat a monster by using mud. And you horror movie geeks out there, I know you already know the one we're thinking of. It occurs in the transition to the third act in the original Predator, the movie starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and basically every other guy with muscles that you could think of in 1987. So I know a lot of you have probably seen this movie, but just in case you haven't, I'll explain the setup to the mud scene. So the premise of the movie is that Arnold Schwarzenegger is leading a group of private military contractors on a hit for the CIA in the jungle somewhere in Central America. Unbeknownst to them, they just happen to be jumping right into the hunting grounds of an alien from another planet who likes to come to war zones on Earth to hunt humans for sport.
Yeah, he likes it hot, he likes it violent, and that's why he's here.
That's right. And I always took it to mean that, like, the Predator seeks out war zones because it's like, you know, the humans aren't going to notice as much that people are going missing.
Yeah, there's always a lot of, there's already distress, there's already people vanishing. It can get in and do its thing without having to worry about stirring up the locals too much.
Oh, but it's also because the Predator wants to hunt, like, the toughest, like, armed humans. Like, he's specifically looking for humans of the Arnold Schwarzenegger with a machine gun variety.
Yeah.
So in this movie, the alien has all kinds of technology that gives the alien an advantage over humans. So, for example, it can put on a cloaking device that makes it nearly invisible to the naked eye. But it also has a huge advantage in that instead of just seeing the world in the visible spectrum of light like we do, it sees in infrared. So the body heat of a living organism really pops out of the background, making any warm-blooded animal easy to track in the forest. So by the end of the second act of the movie, this alien has trophy hunted Arnold Schwarzenegger's entire team. Only Arnold is left. And just when you think he's done for, he ends up, he's running away from the alien. He ends up crawling on his belly across a muddy riverbank so that his entire body ends up covered in mud. And I will note that the mud, I was just thinking back on the scene, it does appear to have a lot of clay-sized particles. I think that's a clay-rich mud.
Yeah, it does look very clay-rich.
But anyway, so yeah, Arnold Schwarzenegger ends up, he's totally covered in mud. He's lying there on the riverbank waiting for the Predator to finish him off. And to his surprise, suddenly it seems like this alien hunter can't see him. The mud has made him invisible to the alien. So finally he has an advantage to even the playing field against this enemy with overwhelming technology. And that sets up the big conflict in the third act. It's a great twist. I remember when I first saw the movie as a kid, I thought it was genius.
It's pretty great. And it's been very influential, because you see this either directly referenced in so many films to come afterwards, or films will find sort of a new way to do the same thing. Like, our hero accidentally find some sort of protection from some sort of an enemy, or, you know, accidentally finds this this key strategy that they can employ against said enemy.
Now, while if I remember correctly, I think nobody in the movie actually explains how this works. You're just left to sort of figure it out for yourself. But the way it is presumed to work is that by covering his body in mud, Arnold Schwarzenegger here has masked the heat signature of his body, because it's now the mud is the same temperature as the rest of the environment, so he just blends in.
Yeah. Now this is a scene that's a lot of fun to dissect, and maybe almost too fun to dissect. Like, you can get a little too wrapped up and trying to break down whether this would work or not. And you have to, at the end of the day, remind yourself, well, we need to experience it through the cinematic excitement of the scene. But still, there are a couple of key conversations about this. I found one that was really interesting that I had not run across before, from a book titled The Sensory Modes of Animal Rhetorics by Alex C. Parrish. And at one point in the book, Parrish examines this scene and seems to have a mostly high opinion of the sequence. He points out that, quote, infrared radiation is nearly impossible to detect through any amount of water. So the wet mud masks Dutch's heat signature, Dutch is the character that Arnold plays, from the predator once his high-tech mask becomes damaged in one of the earlier struggles. I think it's been a while since I've seen Predator in its entirety, but I think part of it, too, is that the predator sees in infrared, but it has kind of like it sees everything in infrared, and it has some of these technological filters it can throw on to sort of refine that a bit.
Yes, and it may have lost some of its capabilities in previous combat. Yeah, I'm not sure though.
Now we'll come back to sort of the science of this. I should point out though that I believe Parrish's main interest in this is not really about like the direct infrared radiation and thermal science of the scenario, but he's more interested in this idea of this being an interaction between two beings with entirely different sensory understandings of the world. And he likes this example because, quote, Dutch is able to think outside his own lived experience and quickly adapt to an alien way of sensing the world. So humans can't detect infrared radiation without the aid of technology, and therefore most of us are just essentially blind to this realm of senses, the direct experience of it, certainly, but also perhaps just sort of the idea of it. And, you throw in a very stressful, life-threatening situation like that depicted in the movie, and, it adds this extra layer to it. So it's kind of neat, like, that ultimately the quality that Dutch has that makes him an effective hero in the movie is not that he has big muscles or he can blow things up. He can do all those things. Those skills seem to serve him well against other humans. But at this point in the movie, he's essentially about to be killed. His trick to surviving is being able to think outside of the human experience and realize why. I mean, part of it's luck too, obviously, that he just happened to get so muddy, happened to fall into that water. Then being swift enough to realize, oh, this is what is happening. This is what has given me the edge.
Yes, but I guess that brings us back to the question of, would something like this work in real life? Like, I don't know, how would it change your infrared heat signature to cover your body in mud?
Well, as I know a number of you out there are familiar with this already, because I think there's a lot of crossover between our listeners and viewers of the TV show Mythbusters, but yeah, there is an episode of Mythbusters that busted this myth. They experimented with a thermographic camera, and they found that it would work, but would only work for a very brief amount of time until the mud heated up from the human body temperature underneath it.
Okay.
And I've seen some other analyses that line up with this as well, arguing that, okay, it could work, but probably not for as long as it seems to work in the movie, also based on like how relative little mud is involved. So I take that to mean if Arnold, aka Dutch here, had just been completely mud monstered himself, like he didn't even look like Arnold anymore, you could make a better case for it working, but then it would have looked a little silly. Like, part of the appeal of the scene too is that, Arnold's face and muscles are covered with this clay-like mud slime.
you can still see the muscles clearly defined, but yes. he looks like he's sort of covered in gray paint.
Yeah. Now, Joe, I think you've seen this as well, but the 2022 film Prey cleverly adapts this, having our hero in this movie, instead of covering themselves with mud, they ingest a traditional medicine that it's described as it lowers one's body temperature through medicinal means, and is able to then, you know, give the hero the same advantage over the predator.
That was a good twist.
Yeah. Now, I guess you could argue that Dutch was also cooling his body temperature because he first jumps off a waterfall, I think, into this water. Then he gets covered in the mud. But I can't imagine that this on its own would have been enough to make a difference. Like, it wouldn't have really it's not like he was jumping into freezing water down there. However, this is just occurring to me now. If we think of what we see in Predator as sort of the myth that's spawned by some sort of an event that actually happened, I could imagine a situation where, okay, Dutch is running for his life, jumps into the cold water, crawls through the mud, is covered with the mud, but instead of then having a direct confrontation with the Predator, already has some distance, and the Predator is not able to scan him from a distance in the short time it takes for him to then get the rest of the way out of range and find a place to hide.
Yeah. Or in the real world scenario, just has a much thicker coating of mud. Like, they didn't have to be concerned in the real world about making sure you could still tell it was Arnold.
Right. Yeah. But then I guess there are all sorts of complications that arise there too. Like, how much mud can you cake on your body without it slouching off? How can you move with all that mud on your body? So there are limitations there as well. I think, if memory serves, and I could be wrong on this, I think in the Mythbusters episode, they found that there were ways to sort of mask your heat signature, but you had to use some sort of like a thermal suit to do that.
Well, I was just thinking, if you make it so that you're not giving off a visible heat signature, wouldn't that just mean you're retaining the heat and therefore you would get really hot?
Well, in this, we're getting really into the thermal regulation side of the whole scenario, which is fortunate because as we venture into the world of real life animals that often cake themselves in mud, wallow in mud, and ultimately use mud for other things, you don't really find animals covering themselves in mud to mask their IR signature. But we're going to look at several examples here of animals using mud for various purposes in their lives. I think we're going to begin with probably the most notable example, the most famous example of a mud-loving animal.
That's right. So one family of animals whose relationship with mud is quite well known is the family Suidae, the family containing all the animals commonly known as hogs, pigs, porkers, and swine. Most notably to humans, Sus domesticus, the common domestic pig. Mm. Now, pigs, along with plenty of other animals like elephants, rhinoceroses, some bovids, etc., wallow in mud. And wallowing is defined as coating the body surface with mud, often simply by lying in a pit of muddy water or even sort of rolling around or wiggling in a pit of muddy water. But when I thought about it, I realized I didn't really know why pigs wallow. My best guess was that it had something to do with temperature, but I didn't know. So to answer this question, I dug up a paper in an animal behavior journal exploring exactly the question of why pigs wallow in mud. So the article was by Mark Bracca, called Review of Wallowing in Pigs, Description of the Behavior and Its Motivational Basis in the journal Applied Animal Behavior Science from the year 2011. And there's some interesting motivating context for this paper, which is that it was really aimed at informing decisions about animal welfare in a domestic context or in agriculture, because, of course, people keep pigs domestically as a farm species and sometimes even as pets. So to treat them humanely means understanding what their needs are. And it has been widely observed that pigs wallow in mud when they can. So is this something that pigs need to do for their well-being? And if so, why do they need to do it? So the paper consists of a literature review of the existing evidence on why domestic pigs and related species such as wild boars coat their bodies in mud. I guess the first question is, what does this actually look like? Well, like when pigs and wild pigs and boars wallow, what do they do? Bracker writes that if a pre-existing pool of mud is not available, pigs will often make their own. They will like dig to make their own wallow. And the pit of mud or muddy water where pigs wallow, the verb, is called a wallow, the noun. So it's kind of like how you shower in the shower. They wallow in the wallow. When a wallow is available, the pig will usually begin by rooting, which means repeatedly pushing the snout in and sort of rooting and digging in the mud. And then they will enter the mud with the forebody first, so head side first, and then wiggle and roll around in the mud, sometimes until much of the body or occasionally even the whole body is covered in mud. Now, how much of their body they submerge in the mud has been observed to correlate somewhat with temperature. According to McGlone in 1999, when the temperature is above freezing, pigs will stand in the cool water. When the temperature goes up from there, more often they will lie down with their udders submerged in the water. And when it's even hotter, they will sometimes like roll around and coat most or all even of the body in mud. But more often the parts of the body that get coated in mud are the sides and the underside. The author says if the wallow is deep enough and the temperature is high enough, sometimes a sow will submerge its entire body, so only the head and the snout is poking out. But on hot days, it's normal for a pig to keep 50 to 75% of its body surface covered in mud. Now, some observers do note that pigs will exhibit wallowing behavior even in cold weather. That'll come back in a bit. But they clearly do it more often in hot weather. Apparently, it becomes really prevalent around 17 to 21 degrees Celsius, which is about 63 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So sometimes a pig will stand or lie down in the mud and just hang out there. Other times the pig will get in the mud, get a coat of the mud, and then leave and let it evaporate as the pig goes about its business, maybe returning later to get another coat. Pigs are often seen scratching off their coats of dried mud against a tree or other scratching post type object. So you might get in the mud, get mud all over your skin, let the mud dry, and then scratch against a tree to get the dried mud off. But what purpose biologically does mud wallowing serve? Well, one of the most obvious and widely recognized benefits is thermoregulation, as we were talking about. Wallowing in mud clearly helps pigs keep cool. Pigs actually have comparatively little in terms of internal biological mechanisms for fighting off the heat, especially compared to some other species. They have fewer sweat glands than humans, for instance. And there was a paragraph in this paper that actually made me feel so much emotion about what it's like to be a pig, about how hot it must be to be a pig, especially a domestic pig. Do you mind if I read this, Rob?
Yes, let's do.
So Bracker writes, "For several reasons, pigs are prone to overheating. Their sweat glands are hardly responsive to elevated temperatures. Subcutaneous fat may result in a relatively high insulation value, and their barrel-shaped body reduces body surface to body mass ratio, and this reduces heat exchange. In addition, compared to wild boar, domesticated pigs have shorter snouts, and this reduces their ability to pant. Furthermore, while domesticated pigs have sparse hair cover and larger ears, their ears are not very mobile and vascularized, as in the case of elephants, and their circulatory system has a limited capacity. Finally, pigs may be producing considerable amounts of heat, e.g. due to muscular activity in feeding, fighting, and play, and very high production levels, growing up to about 1 kilogram per pig per day, producing up to 30 piglets per sow per year." So this just sounds like pigs are busy getting and staying hot. It is hot to be a pig. You need to find ways to cool off. So because of the convergence of all these limitations and their vulnerability to heat, pigs have to supplement their basic sort of internal or anatomical cooling capabilities with behavioral ones. And this could, in some cases, be as simple as reducing your movement and seeking out shade when the sun is high. But it also includes wallowing. So strong is a pig's desire to wallow that in some cases, if water and mud are not available in the pig's environment, they will lie down against any wet surface they can find or even lie against their own feces and urine. Pigs really want to get their skin wet. But it's interesting to consider the complexity of how the wallowing works. Like, it's more complex than simply the way we would jump in water, say, get in the pool to cool off. We all know that it is cooler to be in the pool than out of the pool. And studies show this is, of course, true with the puddles of mud in pig habitats, even if they're in direct sun. But this is not just about the time that the pig is physically in the mud, in the wallow. Because if you think of the pool analogy, when your skin is wet, as you slowly dry off, it takes a lot of energy to turn the water clinging to your skin into water vapor. And that results in a heat transfer from your body to the water as it makes that costly phase transition into vapor. So you can think of why you feel cold after you get out of the shower, even if the shower water was hot.
Yeah, this is a great point. And with I found this with a child, this period of transition between getting out of the swimming pool and going, you know, back into the house or the room or whatever, like this is pivotal. Smaller bodies thrown into the mix as well, because yeah, they're instantly colder when they get out of the pool, but they cannot go back in the pool. And you're going to, I think, maybe have diminishing returns of trying to heat back up in the pool. And for, you know, again, a small-bodied child, this is going to be an even more dire situation. They need those towels. They need to get to a warm shower somewhere so they can warm back up.
Right. And this is also actually the same principle by which sweat cools your body. Water evaporating from the skin makes your body cooler. It's a cooling technique. But another thing you might know from getting out of the pool is that water drips and evaporates off of the skin pretty quickly. So once you leave the pool or the shower, whatever it is, the cooling potential of evaporation is relatively short-lived, probably on the order of just minutes under a hot sun. I'm reminded of a time I was hiking in Big Bend National Park in Texas under, you know, this is a desert environment where like the sun is beating down. And I remember I was very hot. So I took like an icy water bottle that I had and I poured the water just all over myself, like on my head and down my back. So my shirt was soaked in water. And I remember, so I was like, okay, so I'll be good. You know, I'm like wet with this icy water. My clothes are wet. I should be good for a while, but I don't know how long it was, but it felt like within 15 minutes I was bone dry. Hmm. So being wet and evaporating helps you cool off, but it doesn't last that long. Here's the genius of mud wallowing. These studies on wallowing show that an animal such as a wild pig coated in mud stays wet much longer after getting out of the wallow than the same animal coated in water alone. Mud keeps you wet longer than water. And the mud, essentially, it seems like it helps create a matrix for trapping water against the skin, which will still provide the benefits of evaporative cooling as it dries, but the mud may take hours to fully dry into a crust, while like water alone is gone in minutes. To read from the study here, quote, "Wallowing in mud leaves a coat of mud on the pig's lateral and ventral surfaces and limbs. This superficial layer of caked mud assists in relieving hyperthermia through evaporation, acting as a kind of, quote, wet suit, helping to keep cool in a warm environment. Water in mud on the skin of a pig took 2 hours to evaporate compared to 15 minutes when water alone was used, and the evaporation rate was 700 to 800 grams per hour per meter squared. Hence, mud is more effective than clean water in temperature control because mud allows the evaporation process to continue for a longer time. So, for cooling the body in hot conditions, mud is an upgrade from clean water."
All right, that makes sense. Yeah, it's the water just flows right off you. The water evaporates, but the mud sticks. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astepro is a first of its kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astepro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astepro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astepro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astepro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astepro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
So thermoregulation seems to be the most widely accepted explanation for why pigs wallow and the one with the most evidence behind it. But there are a ton of other possible or partial explanations that have been offered. And one reason for this is that there have been observations that while pigs wallow less in cold weather, they still wallow some. So if they're doing it even when it's like really cold outside, it probably must serve some purpose in addition, you know, like some other purpose in addition to just avoiding overheating. So what are some of the other explanations that have been offered? Well, a number of them have to do with various types of grooming and skincare. So imagine this, a pig has ectoparasites on its skin. It might have fleas or lice or ticks or something. The pig cannot reach back and pick all these parasites off. Pig is unfortunately by way of evolution stuck in barrel mode. But the pig can wallow, and by getting in the mud and lying in it, wiggling around, that may kill or dislodge some of those parasites. But then the benefits continue. Even after the pig gets up out of the mud and the mud dries into a crust, the pig can go scratch its body against posts like trees or the pin wall or whatever to remove the mud crust and probably remove trapped parasites along with it.
Oh, I'd never thought about that.
Yeah. So this has been documented as an anti-parasite behavior in water buffaloes. It is assumed by many to serve the same function in pigs, but there's some countervailing evidence the author here cites a study from 2005 that looked for evidence that wallowing reduced parasite loads in wild boar and actually did not find any correlation. So the picture on that one seems mixed. But it's also been proposed that maybe having a layer of mud helps protect pigs from biting insects like flies and mosquitoes. That would make sense. And furthermore, a layer of mud could also help provide protection against sunburn, to which domestic pigs are susceptible. Domestic pigs can get sunburned, being relatively hairless and not having a lot of natural skin protection against the sun. They are vulnerable to sunburn, though I was thinking it's interesting that usually the mud ends up on the sides and the underside of the pig more so than on the back of the pig, which would be the part that's in the most direct sunlight. But yeah, I don't know. Few other possible ideas. Maybe there's some kind of health benefit not related to heat. Pigs have been observed to wallow more when they are suffering from disease. And it's also been hypothesized that pigs wallow in order to perhaps disinfect wounds, because mud in some cases can have bactericidal properties. But this is another hypothesis that was not there was found to be no correlation in that same 2005 study that found no correlation with parasites on wild boar, at least. There are other ideas that maybe it has some relationship to sexual behavior, such as scent marking or advertising mate fitness, but this also seems uncertain. So I'd say the picture is definitely plays a role in thermoregulation, and the fact that pigs also do it when it's very cold makes it seem like maybe it may have some other functions as well, but we're less certain about what those are.
This is all fascinating. Yeah. With pigs in mud, I kind of just had the loose understanding, well, they're doing it to cool down, but it sounds like there are more dimensions to that. And ultimately these additional dimensions cast light on many of the various other examples of wallowing in mud behavior that you see in animals. And we're certainly not going to get into all of these examples today, but you can see how a number of these explanations can and do line up with these other species.
Right. So you might, elephants, rhinoceroses, hippos, water buffalo, other bovids all engage in wallowing behaviors. And to some extent, they probably share some of the same biological purposes. In fact, there was an interesting passage I did want to read from this paper about the evolution of wallowing. So the author writes, quote, "Wallowing, defined widely as covering the body surface with a mud-like substance, is common in mammals such as cervids, carnivores, and primates. Pigs, however, prefer to wallow more specifically in mud, mainly for thermoregulatory reasons, for cooling, and in this respect, it resembles mud wallowing seen in other large animals, giant tortoises, crocodiles, elephant seals, and in particular in the large hairless mega herbivores such as elephants, rhinos, bison, and water buffalo. Pigs probably also descended from a large ancestor, by contrast to, for example, the horse, an odd-toed ungulate, whose ancestor, the Eohippus, was far smaller than his descendant." So if I get what the author is going for here, it sounds like he's suggesting that it's interesting that these species that engage in wallowing today tended to be things that had large-bodied ancestors. Obviously, having a large body means that your cooling needs are more acute. And, a horse, on the other hand, evolves from something with a small body that has less acute cooling needs.
That's fascinating. And, the Galapagos tortoise in particular, they mentioned the giant tortoises. This is a great example. My family and I got to go out and see some of these animals in the wild. And there was one particular morning where, a lot of the tortoises had not yet emerged from their nightly mud. Some were just coming out, but some were still just, firmly parked alone in this kind of wallow of mud. And it was going to be maybe a little bit. The morning was going to have to warm up a bit before they started coming back out again.
But of course, the animal uses of mud are by no means limited to wallowing and thermoregulation. I mean, in a way, you could almost think mud is not quite like water, but it is close to like water in that it is a material and a habitat.
That's right. And there are various other things that animals do with mud that are worth mentioning here. One neat place to start is geophagy. This is something that's been known of in animals since at least the time of Galen. And it's been known that, you know, many animals on occasion will eat soil or clay or something that might be considered mud. This is one of the issues in talking about how animals use mud is we fall back into the issue of definitions that we discussed in the first episode. What's mud? What's not mud? What is more, what would you more consider silt and sand and so forth? When does mud become dirt? So all of those questions and uncertainties remain in effect. But at least in some of these cases, animals would be eating something that you might define as mud. There are three main reasons for them to do this that are recognized. One is to control parasites, endoparasites in this regard. Another is for mineral contents such as iron, sodium, and magnesium, something in the mud that they need for their diet. Another factor is to help metabolize toxic compounds. There are various examples of this in the animal kingdom where at least during part of a season, an animal might be forced to eat some plants that are a little rougher on the gut, and the added mud or dirt into the system will help sort of balance all of that out. Geophagy also factors into some human traditions as well, sometimes as a medicinal practice or other times as part of a survival dietary substitution practice, though. Again, we're focusing on mud here, and this ultimately goes beyond just mud. So it's a stretch, I think, to spend too much time on it, but mud is certainly on the table in the animal kingdom. Now, another big one, of course, is building with mud. Humans, we should note, are famous for building with earth, and mud is a big part of that. And we're going to discuss more about humans specifically in the next episode. But of course, we're not the only animals to make our homes out of mud. There are a few key examples to discuss here. I think one of the most impressive, though, and one that I think a lot of people, if not everyone out there, will have some experience with, is that of the mud dauber or the dirt dauber or the mud wasp.
As a child, I remember really wondering what the word dauber meant.
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up hearing of them as dirt daubers, which is kind of a silly name. And also, since it's like it's mud. Ultimately it's mud. But then the mud dries. That's another one of the definitional problems here. Is that mud only remains mud for a little bit, and then it becomes dried mud or dirt and so forth. But anyway, the mud wasp. I'll call them the mud wasp moving forward because it sounds a little more serious. These are various species of I believe two different families of parasitoid wasps. I definitely encountered these a lot during my own childhood. The resulting nests kind of look like, imagine a pan flute composed of cylinders that instead of being made out of, some sort of, like a metal tubing or bone tubing or wooden tubing or what have you. Instead, those are made out of cylinders of dried mud.
Mm.
And if when, say, cleaning out an old shed or something, you happen to break some of these cylinders open, well, there's an additional level of surprise. You might find that they are full of the remains of tiny spiders.
Mm.
Because while the adults are typically nectar drinkers, the young require the meat and the bodies of host organisms in the form of spiders, which they cram in these cylinders by the dozen. If you've never seen this before, I highly recommend looking up some images on your favorite image search system, because it's grisly. These chambers are just filled with the remains of spiders because they need to be in there so that the young can hatch in or on these spiders and then consume their precious meat. Now, an interesting wrinkle considering mud wasp nests, however, is that, as you may have noticed, while they'll naturally build their nests on naturally occurring wood or naturally occurring rock conditions, human structures of varying styles and materials often offer great environments for them, particularly, if it's something that's exposed to the elements at all, if it's open at all. So barns, sheds, this sort of thing, These are often significantly encrusted in mud wasp nests, to the point that someone may have to come around eventually and scrape them off. I think I've even seen them form on window panes, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
In some cases, they're even building their own mud dwellings on human dwellings or creations that are made out of mud or stone or earth of some sort. And they've been doing this for a very long time. In fact, as pointed out by Finch et al. In a 2019 paper I was looking at in Quaternary Geochronology, the radiocarbon dating of these nests, when attached to things like ancient human rock art and relatively open rock dwellings, can be incredibly insightful. So we're talking like late Pleistocene nests here, which have fossilized. The primary innovator of this approach was an Australian geochronologist named Richard Burt Roberts, Burt being like the nickname. You can call him Burt, apparently. The hope was that given the wide world distribution of mud wasps, this would become something of like a standard tool for dating certain sites of archaeological interest. I've read some other papers that seem to indicate that this didn't quite come to pass. There might actually be limited practical value, but it's still pretty interesting. And apparently, maybe in some cases, can be incredibly insightful when dating something if conditions are just right.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential and then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left, look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
All right, so that's some added detail on a case of an organism using mud that, again, I think a lot of us are familiar with due to the distribution of mud wasps, and also, you know, it's a fairly safe thing to encounter as a kid. But an example I wasn't familiar with concerns fiddler crabs.
Oh, interesting. Now, if I recall, fiddler crabs played a big role in our series called The Lesser of Two Crab Claws about asymmetry in nature.
Yeah. And here they are once more, or at least two species of fiddler crab anyway. So I was reading about this in a 2003 article by Christie et al. Published in Behavioral Ecology and Sociobiology. And they pointed out that there are a couple of key examples of fiddler crabs that do something interesting with the materials that they bring out of their burrows. So obviously one of the things about digging a burrow is you got to bring all that dirt up, right? It's kind of like in the movie The Great Escape. What do you do with all that extra dirt from digging the tunnels? You can't just dump it in one place because then the guards will notice. So you've got to sneak it around. You've got to put it in the cuffs of your pants and secretly deposit it just all over the yard.
Man, how much dirt can you fit in the cuff of your pants?
Well, a little bit at a time, or as much as possible at a time, to try to avoid detection. But, you know, the crabs don't have to worry about that. So the crabs bring these materials out of the burrow. And in a couple of species, you see male fiddler crabs essentially, to some degree, building something out of it next to their burrow. For instance, there's the musical fiddler crab. This is Leptusa musica. And this one will build what is called a sand hood next to the burrow. So this is just like, I mean, picture kind of like a pile of sand. The image that I found of it, it looks kind of like a wave, though. Or kind of like a sail made out of piled sand that's roughly the same height as the crab.
I think of it as sort of a popped collar around the neck hole of the burrow entrance.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. Now, you would be fair in saying, well, that sounds a lot like sand and significantly less like mud, guys. But don't worry, there's another one, and this is BB's fiddler crab. BB's fiddler crab sometimes builds mud pillars next to their burrows. And this seems to help them attract females for mating. Now, as the authors point out here, this is where it's more interesting, is apparently females do seem to prefer going over and hanging out near males and burrows that have a mud tower, or in the case of the musical fiddler crab, that sand hood. They do seem to prefer it, but the practice might not have evolved for mate choice. So in other words, a lot of times things like this occur and we talk about it being like a signal of fitness, like saying, look, I mean, clearly I'm the one to mate with because look what I have wrought. You know, look at this thing that I can, look how much sand I can pile up, right? And that seems to be kind of like our basic way of understanding it. They argue in this paper that it may serve, these may serve as sensory traps, providing shelter for crabs, which crabs, you know, crave to avoid predators. If you've ever walked around on the beach, you know how this works. The crab doesn't really want to be moving out in the open for long. It prefers to stick to crevices and shadows because they're, and of course, holes and burrows because there's safety there. And so the idea here is that selection pressure emerges out of the increased survivability of shade-building male fiddler crabs. So the fiddler crabs that have their sand or their mud piled in such a way as to allow for a little extra shade, a little extra shelter for themselves and for females they might be mating with, these are the ones that tend to survive.
Okay. So not just a mate signal, but an actual, actually useful for survival.
Right. Yeah. And I think their argument, if I'm understanding them correctly, is that, yeah, it's more about that survivability than any kind of signal that they're sending out there, any kind of fitness signal. Though, I mean, just as far as, you know, I'm looking at these pictures and I think I can't stack sand or mud that high where it towers over me. I mean, this one of BB's fiddler crab.
You're thinking I should go mate with that crab.
Well, no, I mean, I just admire it. It's like, could I stack mud up in a pillar or a column that's twice as tall as I am? No, I would be crushed by the mud.
That is impressive.
Other factors are involved, obviously.
Hats off to the fiddler crab, to the BB crab specifically.
Yeah. All right. Mud, of course, is also a nest-building ingredient. Various birds collect mud in addition to other elements to build their nest, using the mud as kind of a, you know, glue or mortar. Swallows are the best example of mud use in birds, but various birds use mud to some degree. But still, if you haven't seen a swallow nest, you should look at one. It looks like a muddy mess. This is not the bird nest that your kindergarten teacher kept in a shoebox to show you.
No, this one looks like a real disaster if it gets wet.
I should also, of course, mention beavers once more. We did a series of episodes on beavers not too long ago. Beavers obviously also use mud in their constructions, which are made out of wood and mud for the most part.
Yeah.
But I want to get to the best example of a mud organism, an organism that thrives on it and in it, and that is the mud skipper. So in the last episode, we discussed mud as this intermediate environment that likely played a greater role in the evolution of land animals than we often consider, right? One of the things that I mentioned in the last episode was like you think of that illustration, that simplistic illustration in a lot of old science textbooks of primordial organisms coming out of the water and taking to land. And it's generally, it looks like it's at your local park, or it looks like maybe it's at the beach or something. Mm-hmm. I often think of also of that Treehouse of Horror episode where the creature crawls out of the water and Homer Simpson sits on it or steps on it. I forget which one it is.
I'm thinking of a fish with human feet, like that like Julius Caesar's horse in that drawing.
Yeah. But like we discussed, like these muddy environments, muddy waters and muddy shores and mud flats, they were probably a lot more important than we often give them credit. And even today, when you consider the mud flats found in coastal wetlands around the world, you'll find vital ecosystems that are home to various specialized organisms. And yeah, the mud skipper is a mud specialist. You may like to go mudding, but the mud skipper lives in the mud. This is the mud skipper's world.
You're in my world now, yeah.
So there are 23 extant species of mud skipper. They're members of the vast Gobidae family, more than 2,000 species and more than 200 genera. Though I've seen that count lower as well, but it's still a lot. There are a lot of gobies in the world.
Hmm.
But gobies, you know what I'm talking about. Most of you probably do. Gobies have kind of a telltale look, right? Their heads, their overall morphology, they look like gobies. There's kind of, I don't know how else to explain it.
They all kind of look like they're saying, hey guys, what's going on?
Exactly. Yeah. I think there's some gobies on SpongeBob. Like they're very SpongeBob-y in their appearance. Now there are 15 genera of air-breathing gobies. But the mud skippers here in particular belong to the genus Periophthalmus, and they have several defining features of note here that aid them in their muddy habitat. So first of all, they have fused pelvic fins, which form a disc-shaped sucker, which aid them by allowing them to sort of attach to surfaces. They can use these to aid themselves in climbing rocks and even trees. Namely, now we're talking about mangroves here, but we're talking about their roots, their trunks, their lower branches. So definitely a case of a fish that can climb a tree.
Wouldn't have thought that.
But of course, this is not the only goby that excels at climbing. There's also a goby that you will find in Hawaii. If you visit certain waterfalls, I don't know if you'll get to see one. I didn't get to see one, but I mean, you know they're there or that they're sometimes there. These are the Oapu Nopili, or Stimpson's goby, and these little guys scale the vertical cliffs of waterfalls.
Wow.
Yeah, you may have seen some videos, some documentary footage about these creatures because they're amazing. It's an amazing journey, especially for something so small.
You know, I knew about flying fish. I don't know why I'm more impressed by climbing fish, climbing up trees and cliffs, than I am with flying fish.
So coming back to the mud skipper, though, yeah, they have specialized morphology for semi-aquatic living on these mud flats. They can breathe air through their skin and the lining of their mouth, though only while wet. You'll often see images of them and footage of them with them with their mouths opening and so forth. They also do this as part of like a defensive display between males. There's a lot of great footage of these males combating each other and having standoffs on the mud.
Mm-hmm.
They are excellent soft sediment burrowers as well. They're great at burrowing in the mud. This is key to their egg laying. They build these burrows. They lay their eggs in the mud. Also, this is how they avoid predators. They jump down those burrows, get out of sight of anything that's trying to eat them. And they also use these for thermoregulation as well. They also work to maintain an air pocket inside the burrow for prolonged stays in low oxygen environments. And you might wonder, too, well, how do they bring the mud back up? Well, they bring it up in their mouths. They bring big mouthfuls and they spit out these mud balls beside the burrow. Joe, I included an image of a mud skipper spitting mud, sort of a ball. It's not as cartoonally ball-like as you might imagine, but here's a mud skipper spitting mud.
So this is the equivalent of you're digging a hole in the ground with the shovel, you're throwing the mud, or not the mud, the dirt over your shoulder. Here it is digging in this wet mud, a sort of tunnel in the mud, and it is spitting out the excess that's being voided from the cavity it's making.
Exactly, yeah. The other interesting thing about them, like their morphology positions their eyes atop their head. They have these big eyes that you might not catch what it is that's amazing about them when you're watching them. That makes them somehow more relatable and more human-like. And part of that is that they blink. They evolved this independently of terrestrial tetrapods.
Well, I said this about gobies earlier in general, but the mud skippers do seem relatable in a way that a lot of fish don't.
Yeah, and they're crawling around on the mud flats. They're engaging in these standoffs with each other. And I think the other part is, like, unlike a fish in the water, of course, in this case, they are also interacting, on a surface. They're out of that 3D marine environment, and here they are on the mud, behaving as these just strange creatures that almost feel very alien. So compared to anything else, because they're not exactly like anything in the water, and they're not like anything on the land. They're totally doing their own thing, and they're doing it in this strange, like, muddy, kind of slimy environment.
I mean, I guess they look like a cross between fish and frogs, which makes sense because they are amphibious fish.
Yeah. I want to say it's BBC's Life, one of the David Attenboroughs, that has some tremendous footage of these guys going about their business. And I think they put a camera down in one of their burrows, so you can see how that's going. Some really remarkable footage. That's from, it's probably at least 10 years old now, but it's out there.
See how it's going.
Yeah, it's going great down there.
Now we're the ones saying, hey guys, what's up?
Yeah.
All right, should we call it there for part two?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's a good overview of some of the ways that animals use mud, like most of the major categories of mud use, and some of the more exciting and notable cases. I'm sure we left off some interesting ones. So if there's one that you really love, just write in, let us know. We'll highlight it perhaps in a future episode of Listener Mail. Because the realm of mud is this world that it's easy for us to take it for granted and not realize just how versatile it is and how essential it is for various organisms.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to have at least one more episode regarding mud this Thursday. Tune in for that. This is going to be the one where we're going to come back and discuss mud and warfare a little bit, but we're also going to discuss the importance of mud as a human construction material, or the creation of mud bricks and so forth. In the meantime, if you would like to listen to other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you will find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed. We have our core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays, Listener Mail on Monday, Short Form, Artifact or Monster Fact on Wednesday, and on Fridays we set aside Most Serious Concerns to just talk about a weird film on Weird Al Cinema.
Huge thanks to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.